Good morning, my friends. Welcome back to the big show, Frankly Speaking Radio, heard around the world on the Republic Broadcasting Network. I'm your host, Frank Will, and glad to have you with us, my friends. My guest is now with us. Very pleased to have him. His name is Jared Taylor, and he is part of a group called American Renaissance, a monthly magazine that's been published since 1991. And it talks about many things, including immigration, which is what we're going to talk about today. In fact, you may have seen the post on our website, which we put up over a week ago, which was entitled Guide for the Mexican Migrant. Now, this is the booklet that was distributed by the Mexican Ministry of Foreign Relations to, guide illegal immigrants is the most effective way to accomplish their goal. And I wanted to talk to him about it. Ladies and gentlemen, let's welcome here Jared Taylor. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Pleased to have you with us. I appreciate you agreeing to do the interview. Now, let's talk about this. You guys translated this guide and posted on your website with the English translation as well as, I assume, photos or I should say drawings that are actually in this booklet, this comic book-looking thing. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. This turned up on the Internet, as you said, about a week ago, and we have had it translated immediately, because we thought it was very significant that Americans know what the Mexican government is saying to Mexicans about how to break into the United States. And the booklet was originally issued in comic book form. More than 1.5 million of these have been distributed free to Mexicans in the northern parts of Mexico and in other places where people are most likely to go to the United States. And the comic book drawings, everybody looks like a superhero, practically. You see these Mexicans swimming the river. They look like muscle men, you know, and all the Mexican ladies who are crossing the border. They look like beauty queens. The drawings are quite hilarious and almost worth going to the website just to look at the drawings. But the point of it is, here is the Mexican government very clearly telling its citizens how to get into the United States, what to think about when you cross the river or cross the desert, how to live in the United States without being detected and thrown out. It's a clear invitation to break our immigration laws and come into the United States without a visa. And then the hidden message, of course, the unstated message, I would say, is stay there, send money back, and increase the influence of Mexico and Mexicans within the United States.
Well, I think certainly we've seen many, many, many stories in the mainstream media which all indicate the same thing. In fact, you may have heard my last caller there before we came to you was talking about a forthcoming war and sort of what's going on. I think that there's certainly a case to be made for that. I probably went through 60 or so stories in the first 2 hours of the show just validating all through mainstream media sources about Iran and Syria sort of being in the crosshairs. Now, one of the things that has always boggled my mind, and I'm sure many people out there, is how can our politicians in this state of homeland security, sort of state of where we are, we are very concerned about terrorists coming into these countries. Now, we've all plainly seen and heard all the stories about Middle Easterners described as Mexicans coming across the southern border and so on and so forth. This should be a matter of top priority and a matter of extreme urgency from these politicians. And yet Bush and others are pushing for immigration reform and whatnot. Now, one of my theories, and I want to know your thoughts on this, is that the I think it's H.R. 163 that was proposed initially, which was a draft, a mandatory military service in some capacity for all persons in the United States, males and females, 18 to 26. Now, it doesn't say citizens. So that is one reason I thought, hey, you know, let's have some soldiers come on over. We can go ahead and draft them and ship them abroad. I mean, can you think of what are your thoughts on that theory and any other reasons why our politicians would be as on board with this as Vicente Fox?
Well, the fact is what the United States is doing, namely letting aliens into its country at an alarming rate in such a way as that whites will, in a few decades, be reduced to a minority. What the United States is doing is historically unprecedented. Never before has a political unit or even a tribe or any other entity voluntarily let aliens come in and take over and become a majority. Never before have people done this. And so I think you have to look for pretty deep reasons for people to do such a thing. I think in George Bush's case, that guy just doesn't think very far ahead. All he can see he wants to get another 10% of the Hispanic vote, and he thinks that by being kind to Mexicans and by granting amnesty to the illegals who are already here, he's going to curry favor with Mexicans, and so that Republicans will get a few more votes in the next election. What he doesn't realize, of course, is that Democrats will always get the majority of the Hispanic vote, and the more Hispanic the country becomes, the less likely it will ever be that you'll ever get another Republican elected to the presidency. All of these aspects are carefully detailed on our website, along with this crazy comic book that your listeners can go to at amren.com. And these are issues that we have dealt with in American Renaissance for many years, and the back issues are also available on our website. But the question really is quite a profound one, and frankly, I can't give you an entirely satisfactory answer. Why should a nation that has the power to resist dispossession, why should it just open itself up and say, okay, you folks from every failed country around the world, you people who've made a mess of your own countries, come on in, make yourselves at home, become a majority, stamp your language, your culture, your failed ways on our nation, help yourselves. People just don't do that. It's an utterly unnatural, inexplicable thing.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas what the Mexicans are doing is perfectly natural. They say,
yes.
Hey, well, look, here's a great place. We sneak across the border, and we get affirmative action. They must think it's going to rain beer next.
Well, I don't know. But you're right. It is inexplicable, which leads me to think that this is not just George Bush being a moron. He's a moron, certainly, and in many ways. But it just seems to me that this, there's got to be some design behind this besides just sort of pandering to a future, voting majority.
Yes. Well, there are a few other interests that benefit from swarms of low-cost labor coming into the country. Obviously, agricultural employers, people who run poultry factories, sausage makers, these people that have a desire for low-cost labor, they're interested in having them come into the country. And people will say, well, gosh, look, I can hire these Mexicans. They work hard. I only have to pay them $6 an hour. What a bargain for America. What they don't realize, of course, is that when the $6 an hour Mexican, he's got his wife who's got no medical insurance. When she has a baby, you and I get to pay for it. When they get sick, you and I pay for it. When he gets drunk Saturday night, stabs his buddy, goes to jail, we have to pay for the interpreters. We have to pay for the jail. There is a huge social cost here. Their children, they come in with children, they don't speak English. We get to pay for the bilingual education. Our children then have to sit there in classes with Mexicans who don't speak English. The whole level of education is dragged down. The $6 an hour, that is just a tiny aspect of the situation. And in fact, if you calculated out the costs, really and realistically, economically, culturally, and in terms of the future of the country, we're paying $600 an hour to these people who will swing a pick for us. Now, it's an extremely short-sighted and, I think, as I say, historically unprecedented capitulation on the part of one people vis-a-vis the rest of the world, and specifically against Mexicans.
Yeah, there are certainly a lot of problems out there. Now, What is the estimated number of illegal immigrants crossing the border, any border, into the United States every year?
Well, the figure that people bandy about, and of course no one knows for sure, they
True.
Figure maybe a million cross the Mexican-American border every year. A smaller figure, some several hundred thousand cross in from Canada, but the larger number is from Mexico, maybe a million every year. Of that number, the figure is that people go back across the border, too. It's not strictly a one-way street, but every year we seem to add maybe another 300,000, 400,000. The estimates as to the number of illegal aliens in the United States, that's also is extremely varied. They go as high as 20 million. At the present time, Mexico alone has approximately 20% of its entire population living in the United States. 20 to 25 million Mexicans out of a population of 100 million. And one of the reasons why the Mexican government encourages its citizens to go north by means of these comic books and instruction as to how to cross the border and live amongst us illegally is because Mexicans living here send back $15 billion a year in remittances. after oil exports, that is the second highest foreign exchange earner for Mexico. So these people are a tremendously important source of revenue. It's also a way for the Mexicans to get rid of excess population that they cannot employ. And at the same time, these are Mexicans who are stamping a kind of Mexican loyalty all across the United States that's recognized in places like the Movement for the Chicano Student Movement, or MECHA, whose express purpose is to break off a chunk of the southwestern United States, call it Aztlan, kick out all whites, and make that the Bronze Continent, as they call it, an entirely Chicano republic. Their interests in dismembering the United States or perhaps absorbing it into Mexico are explicit. And yet, are we supposed to just ignore this and think, oh, isn't this charming and cute? I mean, their objectives could not be clearer. And yet the United States government thinks this is wonderful.
Yeah, yeah. And certainly you could see the connections there between the politicians and the corporations. That makes a lot of sense, actually.
I'm sorry,
if I can interrupt here, Jared, briefly. Time for a commercial, my friends. We'll be right back with more from Jared Taylor from American Renaissance. If you want to check out the guide for the Mexican migrant, you can go to their website, amren.com, linked up through our website, of course, franklyspeakingradio.com. We'll be right back. Good morning, my friends. Welcome back to the big show, Frankly Speaking Radio, heard around the world on the Republic Broadcasting Network. I'm your host, Frank Whelan. Pleased to have you with us here today. We are chatting with Jared Taylor from American Renaissance about their translation of the Guide for the Mexican Migrant. Folks, this is a really amazing thing. You should certainly read it. I tell you what, it really shocked me, and I had to track these guys down. And Jared, of course, was gracious enough to give us some time today. Jared, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Was there anything in particular that stood out in your mind with that that comic book that really sort of, I guess, surprised you or, something that maybe people don't know enough about?
It's surprising only if you don't know the other things that the Mexican government is doing. They have a special branch of the foreign ministry called Grupo Beta, that's Group B, that they station people on the border, and they find people who are heading north. And they explain to them verbally some of the things that are included in this comic book about how to be sure and take salt tablets with you when you're crossing the desert. Make sure and wear light clothing if you're trying to cross the river, because heavy clothing can get waterlogged and drag you down. They explain to you what your rights are if you're arrested. And after they have delivered these lectures to groups who are crossing over, they will say, and God bless you and good luck. In other words, Godspeed on your voyage into the United States. Also, Grupo Beta has put water supplies on the Mexican side of the border so that people who are heading north can tank up and not dehydrate in the desert. Also, the fact that Mexico just recently made it possible for Mexicans to have dual citizenship, and they did this specifically so that Mexicans could get U.S. citizenship, influence laws in the United States, vote for Mexican and Mexican-American candidates, and still maintain their Mexican citizenship. The fear was, you see, in the past, Mexicans were not becoming American citizens because they are basically loyal to Mexico, and if they became U.S. citizens, they would lose their citizenship rights in Mexico, which they didn't want to do. Now, of course, while maintaining loyalty to Mexico, they can become U.S. citizens. They are eligible for all the benefits of citizenship. They vote in U.S. elections in ways that are the benefit of that benefit Mexico. So if you have the background for all of the things Mexico has been doing, for example, the fact that President Vicente Fox not long ago described illegal immigrants as heroes. He addressed them as heroes. If you have the background here, then this comic book just fits in perfectly with their plan to send as many people north to influence our culture, influence our elections, and send American money back to Mexico.
Now, here we are in this sort of turbulent time here in the United States, and certainly just like any other patriot, I have problems with everything going on here. But, I don't feel the need to leave the country. You know, a lot of people here are talking about expatriation. They're talking about leaving. Oh, we can't have Bush as president. I'm going to run away to Canada or wherever. And I also don't want to leave because I think that if it can be fixed, I want to be part of fixing it. And I'm just trying to process the mindset of an illegal immigrant, wherever they're from, of why they would want to run away from their country. If there's so many of them, they could certainly institute some changes and make their country a better place to live. Wouldn't you agree?
No, I wouldn't agree.
Okay.
Mexico has been run by Mexicans ever since it became independent in the early 19th century, and they have not made it a pleasant place to live. Mexico, like practically every heavily mestizo Latin American country, is a disagreeable place to live. And so the reaction of many Mexicans, particularly if they're uneducated, unemployed, have absolutely no future in Mexico, they can cross the border and go from a place where they can arrive in a place where the minimum wage in the United States is six times higher than the average wage in Mexico. Just by crossing the border, they can improve their financial situation so marvelously, live in a country where the police are not corrupt, where the telephones work, where you can drink the water without getting sick. They can better themselves economically just by crossing that border. And so, of course, they come. In that respect, it's not surprising, and it's hard to blame them. What is surprising, as I said before, is that we permit them to come and bring their own forms of criminality and disorganization and social structure that doesn't work in Mexico. We allow them to come here and set that back up here. Just as an example, in the entire United States, there is not a single school district where Hispanics, primarily Mexicans, perform at anything near the level of white children in the schools. Wherever you go, the more Hispanics you have, the more it tends to drag down the performance. And, of course, as a result, white parents pull their children out of those schools. They become more and more Mexican, more and more Hispanic, in some cases more Hispanic and black, and the quality of education continues to plummet. That's just one example of what happens when an area of the country becomes heavily Hispanic. And why we should inflict this on ourselves, that is the great mystery.
So, you know, in looking at your website there on the information section, You mentioned that race is an important aspect of individual and group identity. Would you consider yourself a racist by common definition?
Well, I don't know what the definition of racist these days is. Practically anyone who disagrees with a black or Hispanic these days can be called a racist. But whatever a racist is, it's someone with an immoral view or
okay.
A disreputable position. My views on race are
perfectly hang on a second,
moral.
Jared. I got a commercial. We'll be right back, folks, with more Frankly Speaking Radio. Stay with us. Good morning, my friends, and welcome back to the show. We call it Frankly Speaking Radio. Heard around the world on the Republic Broadcasting Network. I'm your host, Frank Whalen. Welcome back. And ladies and gentlemen, we are chatting with Jared Taylor from American Renaissance, in particular about their Guide for the Mexican Migrant Translation, which provides the actual drawings from this comic book-like sort of how-to be successful in your attempt to illegally immigrate to the United States. It's very shocking. And I came across it, as I said, I think it was somewhere around the 10th. And I think we did post a link on it. And, of course, then I was able to track down American Renaissance. And, of course, Jared Taylor agreed to the interview today, and I appreciate that. Jared, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
Sorry for the interruption there. Please go ahead, sir. You were just talking about the definition of racist versus what you believe.
Yes, this is an important question. These days, anyone who, for example, points out empirical obvious facts, let's say the fact that blacks are on a per capita basis about 10 times more likely to commit murder or mugging than whites. If you simply point that out, it's a verifiable fact. There are certain people who will accuse you of racism simply for pointing that out. Or if I pointed out to a number of radio audiences on Martin Luther King Day, if you say that, no, Martin Luther King does not deserve the highest honor a nation can give, he does not deserve to have his birthday made into a national holiday. If you express that's not an empirical fact, it's an opinion. It's an opinion that you can justify in all sorts of ways, but simply by expressing an opinion that offends certain minorities. Just by doing that, you can be called a racist. So doing all sorts of perfectly normal things can bring about a charge of racism. I reject such charges completely. My views on race are very carefully considered, and I would defend them with absolute confidence as being entirely natural and completely moral.
Fair enough. Well, I mean, obviously, and I agree with you to a certain extent, that I do think that we are in this, we have sort of gone down the political correctness line way too far, to the point where myself, I've come out and said that I think that slavery reparations is a horrible idea for a number of reasons, primarily, of course, because you get that paycheck, that doesn't justify what was done. And by accepting that money, I think you're saying, hey, everything's okay now. Secondly, the particulars of it just seem to be impossible to work out. So, but by saying that, I was accused of being a racist.
Of course. Of course.
You know, coming out and reading stories from the mainstream media in which Ariel Sharon says we control America, you take a good look at all of our elected representatives and where they get paid, and you can certainly see that Israel plays a predominant role in our policymaking. I can be called an anti-Semite. Being against illegal immigration, regardless of where they come from, I can be called a racist. So,
That's right. You
know, I agree with you on that regard. But I mean, some of these comments, they are pretty inflammatory. I mean, how do you rationalize? How do you justify this? I mean, I know you said that you can, you know, make your case. I would like to hear it just to get that very important question, as you stated, out of the way.
Oh, you mean the comment that race is an important aspect
Yes. Of
individual or national identity?
Yes.
Oh, well, I think that's a quite empirically verifiable fact, too. It would be impossible to find a multiracial country where there is not racial division. In fact, we can find it very obviously in the United States today. All across the country, people are trying very hard to promote integration. In schools, for example. And children can be assigned in class to sit next to people of a different race. Blacks, Hispanics, Asians, whites, they have them all sit next to each other. However, the one thing that no school seems to be able to achieve is lunchroom integration. That is to say, when the students are left to themselves, when they choose where they sit among people like themselves. That is a practically universal phenomenon. Likewise, on college campuses, you have organizations that represent people of different races and different groups. You have Hispanic student associations. You have black student associations. You have the same thing in professional organizations. There is no large police force or firefighting force in the country that does not have its Black Officers Association or Black Police, Black Firefighters Association. Likewise, in Congress, you have a black congressional caucus, a Hispanic congressional caucus. Their race, their ethnicity, these are hugely important to them in terms of who they are and who they feel they represent. It's an obvious fact in that respect. And so both individually and as a group, race plays a very important role. We are a species that is simply tribal. We have limited loyalties and limited identifications. When people talk about the brotherhood of man, that's a bunch of moonshine. Nobody considers all of humanity his brothers. And we have these limited, very strong loyalties to people who are like ourselves. It's simply part of human nature. And to attempt to build a society in a way that denies that aspect of human nature, I think is to set ourselves up for terrible failure.
Well, then, to take it down that road, if you're saying that this is such an important part of society, aren't you in essence saying that that society can, in essence, only have one race?
Societies are much stabler when they're homogeneous. Take a country like Japan. They don't have race riots. They don't have affirmative action. They don't have civil rights commissions. They don't have these blue ribbon committees that try to establish ways to get races to get along because they just don't have that problem. I think that that's the same in every homogeneous country, whereas when you have non-homogeneity, and it doesn't have to be racial, it can be linguistic, it can be religious, it can be ethnic, it can be all kinds of things, but when you have diversity of the kind that we are supposed to be celebrating, it results in conflict. Look just across the border north. Quebec has a very strong independence movement based on language. In Sri Lanka, you have a civil war. It's an ethnic civil war. The Tamils and the Sinhalese, they are ethnically different and religiously different. In the Sudan, you have a civil war, where in the north you have Muslim Arabs, in the south you have animist and Christian blacks. Wherever you have that kind of distinction, you have conflict. Balkanization is the term that's come up to describe that, where you have different ethnicities, different religions, there is conflict. It is only storing up problems when you take what was once a homogeneous society, or more or less homogeneous society like the United States, and start importing people who are as unlike each other as possible. You're just playing with fire when you do that, and there's no instance in which that has resulted in happy harmony.
So the solution would be to just comb through the United States and get rid of everyone who doesn't speak English or does not have the same skin color.
No. I've never advocated any forcible removal.
All right.
The only positions that American Renaissance has ever advocated is that we end immigration. I mean, after all, when's the last time you were driving down the highway and you thought to yourself, my gosh, there are not enough cars on the road? And when's the last time you were driving through the countryside and you said, gosh, too many trees. We need another strip mall here. We've got enough people, for heaven's sake. And at the rate we're going, by the end of the century, we're supposed to have 500 million people here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in 1945, when the United States won the Second World War, we had 125 million people living in the country. And nobody thought the place was underpopulated. We just don't need any more people. But, so, immigration, I think, is a terrible problem for the United States. The other is, I would end all anti-discrimination laws. People should have the right to associate freely. When they do have the freedom to associate, people generally do end up spending their time with people like themselves. When they're forced into the company of others, they don't necessarily slit each other's throats, but when they are free to be among themselves, if you go to a 4th of July party, a dinner party, a wedding reception, chances are it's going to be pretty homogeneous, and that reflects the nature of man. So we should have a society, I'm not talking about forcibly removing anyone, but we should have a society that recognizes the nature of man rather than a society built on all sorts of illusions about the way man ought to be.
So what could we do to change that? Is it just immigration the only issue? And I presume you mean legal and illegal.
Legal and illegal.
Okay.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
These days, it's almost fashionable to be opposed to illegal immigration. And, well, it's idiotic not to be. These are people who break our laws to come to our country. And as you pointed out earlier, we're in a situation of heightened national security. If we can't even control our borders, if we're getting millions of people coming across the Mexican border, how can we be certain that some of these people are not just coming to work for $6 an hour digging ditches? Some of them are coming because they want to kill us. And if we can't control our borders, that is obvious lunacy. And for George Bush to talk about granting amnesty to these lawbreakers, that's lunacy on stilts. And fortunately, even within his own party, he will face tremendous opposition if he tries to push through policies of that kind. But what it means in terms of policy is stopping legal and illegal immigration. Unless we could be very selective about legal immigration. We could admit only those who are clearly going to fit in. We could restrict it to Europeans who speak English, who have high intelligence, who have assets. People who are clearly going to contribute to our country. We could have a selective immigration policy of that kind, but as I said earlier, at this point, we really don't need any more people. We're going to be pushing 300 million before long, and as I say, back in 1945 with 125 million, nobody was looking around saying, gosh, we need another 100 million people.
Right, but, you know, again, saying selective immigration, people who speak English who are, you know, European, that they can contribute to society, implying that anyone who doesn't speak English at all, and I think that obviously if we were going to move to another country, we would be forced to adapt. We wouldn't expect them to start putting up signs in our neighborhood that are in English and so on and so forth. So I understand that. But to make the statement that only those people who are European and speak English would be able to contribute to society, I disagree with that.
Well, clearly there are exceptions to that, but you can generally count on white English-speaking people to assimilate with the least amount of trouble. And let's put it this way. We owe the citizens of other countries nothing in terms of who we decide to let to come in here. This is our country. We make the rules. Now, once you're a U.S. citizen, then, of course, there are no grounds on which to treat people differently. But people who are not living here, we can say no immigrants at all. Some immigrants, lots of immigrants. The decision is up to us. And our immigration policy should be based on our interests, not on the interests of the immigrants. And it seems to me quite clear that, say, if you're going to bring in 10,000 Englishmen, they're going to assimilate a whole lot better than 10,000 Bantus. I mean, there's just no comparison. So why is it wrong to look at our immigration policy in terms of how it benefits us rather than how it may benefit someone who is coming from a failed country?
Well, I think, you can make a case, but I'll tell you what. I mean, some of the rationalizations sound very racist to me.
Well,
and I mean,
let's look at it this way.
Okay.
Up until 1965, the United States had an immigration policy that was designed specifically to keep the country majority white. It was a 90% white country, and the people who lived here, the people who built its institutions, their intention was to keep it that way. Is that a bad thing? No, I don't think it's a bad thing. It's perfectly natural and normal. Take Israel. Yitzhak Rabin, who was assassinated, I guess getting on to about 10 years ago or more now, very shortly before he was assassinated, he gave an interview at U.S. News and World Report, and he was talking about his accomplishments, and he said, well, there are many things I'm proud of, but the thing that I worked hardest for and the thing that I care about the most is that Israel remain at least 80% Jewish. Well, what he is saying is, if Israel is to have a certain character, if Israel is to be a Jewish state, it has to have a Jewish majority. And my view would be, if the United States is to have a certain character, it has to have a majority that is European, that is white. Everywhere you go in the United States, the whites have become a minority. The whole texture of life has changed. People do things differently. And the entire nation, its institutions will change if it becomes majority Hispanic or black. That is an inevitability. And the people who are descended from the founders of this country, I think, have every right to wish to maintain the country that their ancestors founded rather than see it transformed through immigration.
Well, like I said, that sounds racist to me. Do you want to take some calls?
Sure, by all means.
All right, folks, I guess let's see what you guys have to think. 1-800-313-9443, toll free, and worldwide, 1-800-313-9443. Now, we get a lot of people from all over the world who participate in the show. Jared, call
sure.
in. And, I don't ask them their color of their skin or their first language to determine whether or not they have something to contribute. I do think that there is a commonality that is pervasive, it crosses all borders and all countries, and that is, of course, the quest for the truth. Now, I'm not saying that I think that we should just have, when I call up a radio station, I get an automated response that lists every single language under the sun.
Right.
I do think that if you come to another country, the same way if I were to go somewhere else and I had to learn, I would have to learn the language, plain and simple. So I do
sure.
think some concessions have to be made, but I don't think you can say only European countries, because there are quite a few European countries, I personally, just overall, that I wouldn't want anything to do with. Individuals is a different thing. You can look at a country as a country, but an individual has to be treated like an individual.
Let's put it this way. Do you think that the Israeli policy of letting all Jews immigrate but nobody else immigrate, is that racist and indefensible?
Yes.
Well, okay, then you're being consistent. How about the fact that in Japan doesn't let anybody immigrate except for Japanese who emigrated, who left the country generations before and went to places like Brazil, for example. If you are Japanese, of Japanese origin, then you can go back to Japan. Is that racist and indefensible also?
I was unaware of that, so it sounds like it.
You say that it was. Well,
yeah.
What about the fact that Mexico, for example, they have basically no immigration policy at all. You can go live in Mexico, but you can't become a citizen, and as a non-citizen, you can't buy land there. And I think that if, let's just imagine the shoe were on the other foot. Let's imagine that hundreds of thousands of white English-speaking people were pouring across the border into Mexico, And they were demanding instruction in English. They were buying up radio stations, broadcasting in English. They were talking about celebrating July 4th rather than Cinco de Mayo. They were insisting that schools be set up to teach them in their own language, vote in English. Do you think the Mexicans could be persuaded that this was some wonderful form of diversity and enrichment?
No.
No, obviously they couldn't. The fact is, all nations have a tribal sense. They want to stay the way they are. You couldn't persuade the Koreans that it's in their benefit if Haitians and Nicaraguans and Canadians and Italians came pouring in, creating local majorities and changing the character of Korea. That would be unfair to ask them to. It's only in white countries where we have been taught to think that it is somehow acceptable not to try to maintain the country of our ancestors. Every other country operates on that basis and absolutely takes it for granted. And that's why what I'm saying is perfectly natural and I believe entirely moral. What I say for the United States is exactly the right. I want the rights for the United States that I recognize to every other country. I can't go live in Ghana and become a Ghanaian. They wouldn't think of it. And I think what's sauce for the goose should be sauce for the gander.
All right, let's go to the phones. Maggie in Texas, welcome to the show.
After hearing these last comments, my comment has changed. Actually, I have two. One is the gentleman is mistaken in believing that Americans cannot purchase land in Mexico or purchase property. That has been changed. They can now. And in fact, what's being encouraged is a retirement community of white people of sufficient means to sustain themselves. They like that. They like that American money being there and coming there. And so it is to their benefit that they allowed this. But it has been changed. He should look it up. You can purchase property, and lots of people are.
Well, you can purchase property through a corporation. But your rights are not the same as those of a Mexican citizen.
Oh, right. I was not claiming that. I was addressing only that one point. There's, you know, the expatriate communities have their own deal down there.
Exactly.
But they are buying houses, yeah.
Yes, but it's not on the same status as a Mexican, and they could easily change the law at any time.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
I understand that, yeah.
Yes, that's a significant point.
Okay, my second, I am aware of that, although I don't think that's going to happen real soon for various reasons. Now, my original point, I was intrigued by one particular comment of yours to the effect that that Mexico is now granting dual citizenship to Mexicans who come up here. And my question would be, has the United States sort of, for lack of a better expression, dumbed down the immigration requirements or naturalization requirements for people to become citizens up here? It used to be a very difficult test in the time of my grandparents. I know that.
Yes, used to be extremely difficult. Mm-hmm. And just as one example, they used to take the requirement of speaking English seriously.
Uh-huh,
had to be a competent English speaker in order to become a citizen.
Mm-hmm.
Now, although that's still on the books, the test of English is so simple that you can learn enough key phrases to pass it with no difficulty at all. And even our government recognizes that American citizens, many of them don't speak English competently because we require ballots to be printed in foreign languages.
Mm-hmm.
If the electorate exceeds, if the, say, Chinese-speaking electorate exceeds 5% of any given jurisdiction, we require that that jurisdiction print ballots in Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how more obviously could you concede the point that although theoretically we require that they speak English, as a practical matter, we recognize that they don't. That's a pathetic concession and capitulation.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, the oath of citizenship requires that the new citizen renounce any loyalty to any foreign prince, potentate, republic, etc. And in fact, when it has been pointed out that there are many who clearly have maintained their loyalty to their former country, the courts have said, that doesn't matter anymore. There have been court cases on this very point. So you can lie in your oath of citizenship and pretend to be loyal to the United States and yet maintain a loyalty to another country, and that's perfectly okay. So those are two examples of how our naturalization process has been corrupted.
Yeah, we seem to be giving out dual citizenship with abandon now, and that's something I only recently became aware of.
That's right. I think dual citizenship is a little bit like bigamy. You know, you should have one you should have one nation to which you are committed. The idea that you are loyal to two nations. Look, it's entirely possible that someday there could be a very sharp conflict between the United States and Mexico over perhaps the use of the waters of the Rio Grande, over some sort of international pollution problem. Who knows what problems could arise between us and Mexico? When that happens, I can promise you, there will be millions of U.S. citizens who will take the Mexican side. Is that a healthy state of affairs? It certainly is not.
Okay, thank you, sir. You've answered my question.
My pleasure.
Maggie, thank you for the call. Let's go to Drew in Little Rock. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
God bless you. Maggie kind of stole my thunder there. As a real estate broker, I have specific knowledge in the fact that you can buy and sell land in Mexico as an American. The laws were changed, but you are correct in stating that the law can be changed back to where Americans or other Europeans cannot own land. But that can be held just about in any country in the world. So the excuse there is that you said that they could change the law. That's liable in just about any South American country there is. I disagree with your statement that you made earlier about prior to 1965, America was pro-white of immigrants. Specifically disagree with that in the sense of the availability of the Japanese and the Chinese that were available to come into the United States. And the segregation issue goes all the way back to 1913 when President Wilson, a Democrat, came to power. And prior to 1913 and after the Civil War, blacks and whites worked alongside each other. Specifically in Washington, D.C., and a lot of offices around the United States. When Wilson took power in 1913, the segregation issue arose in a case known as Brown versus U.S., and this was a case with a heavyweight boxer who was trying to fight for the championship, and the boxing administration would not let him fight the champion of the time. Now, again, I applaud you 100% on your website. I've reviewed it. I applaud you with what you have to say, specifically about the Americans that are here that have an allegiance to other countries. Where does their allegiance really lie? I applaud you with your facts on the fact that there's the Mexicans that come to the United States earn six times the income. You fail to mention that the Mexicans that do come across the border spend 80% of the money back to Mexico.
Hold on a second here, Drew. Yes, I'll hold you over, Drew. And Jared, I'd love for you to stay as well, sir. Good morning, my friends. Welcome back. You are listening to Frankly Speaking Radio, heard worldwide on the Republic Broadcasting Network. I'm your host, Frank Whalen. It is Wednesday, January 19th, 2005. Final hour of the show, the fourth hour, 9 a.m. Central Time on the nose. Glad to have you with us here, folks. The website is franklyspeakingradio.com. A link to our guest website, which is amren.com, amren.com. And there's a comment page there as well. You can comment on the interview that we are having right now, and you can call in as well, 1-800-313-9443, toll-free and worldwide, 1-800-313-9443. My guest today, Jared Taylor from American Renaissance. Jared, welcome back. Now, do you mind staying over? Because we're getting so many calls. I know people want to talk, and you're doing such a great job.
Well, thank you. No, I'd be happy to stay on.
Well, I would be thrilled to keep you here, and, of course, just because... You know, I tell my audience that they have to make up their own mind. They have to think for themselves. It matters what they think. It doesn't matter what you think, Jared. It doesn't matter what I think. It matters what they think.
Indeed.
And it's important for them to get their questions answered. So I appreciate that. Let's go back to Drew in Little Rock. Drew, welcome back.
Thank you, sir. Again, I applaud Jared for coming on this program and putting out the information, because we, the American citizen, need to lick our eyeballs up and see the facts as they really stand. 51% of the possible electorate of America did not vote in the last major election. That 51% could literally have voted in a third-party president if they all voted for that other party. But enough said with that. We have got to start protecting our borders. And your statement, Jared, I applaud you with the knowledge of the standards and going to other countries. I have a large number of former military Marines that have moved to places like Venezuela and back to Southeast Asia. And the countries that they've moved to had requirements that they have X amount of dollars in the bank. A case in point is Belize. If you have to have $50,000 to move to Belize, and that is above and beyond what you buy the property for.
Mm-hmm.
$50,000 is a lot of money in America. $50,000 is a small fortune in Belize. You take $50,000 and move into Venezuela, and it would be like having $1 million in Austin, Texas.
I think the point is that every other country has an immigration policy that's very carefully controlled in the interest of that country.
Yes, sir. I agree. And yes, we don't.
That's right. And it's a terrible thing. Now, as far as our immigration policy up until 1965, you seem quite well informed on a number of points. But the fact is, we had a system of quotas that was devised in 1924. So that the ethnic balance of the immigration stream had to reflect the people who were already here.
Yes,
Asians were excluded by the Asian Exclusion Act, some of them back when immigration was a state matter, or back in the 19th century. But after the Russo-Japanese War in 1915, I believe it was, we agreed with the Japanese that there would be no Japanese immigration to the United States, and there was none right up until the Second World War. The people who were living here then had come earlier than that. Also, we found that the Exclusion Acts were keeping out Chinese immigration, and so Chinese immigration was only allowed during the Second World War when we found ourselves in alliance with China. We have been a very exclusive nation in various parts of our history, and as I say, from about 1924 to 1965, our laws were very clearly designed to keep the country majority white.
Let me take a break here. Good morning, folks, and welcome back. Of course, you are listening to Frankly Speaking Radio, and I am Frank Whalen. Thanks for being here with us. It is our final hour of the program, and the phone number, if you'd like to weigh in, is 1-800-313-9443. Our guest today, Jared Taylor from American Renaissance. Jared, welcome back, and Drew is back as well. You know, Drew, you were sort of highlighting some of the things about other countries' policies against the United States, and I agree, it's not fair. But at the same time, why do you care, Drew? Because you know, you're a patriot. Why would you ever want to leave this country in the first place? Hello,
I'm here.
All right.
I would not. I have not thought about leaving America. I probably will die for. In the upcoming battle that's going to be in the streets. So
I agree.
I bring it up only in the sense that there are friends of mine that that live here have moved down to Venezuela and bought land and basically set up a safe haven so they could, you know, their offspring, i.e. their wives and kids, can be sequestered away from this upcoming fight and battle that I foresee in the near future. So
yeah,
as far as caring, I don't care.
Right.
The least, I do appreciate Jared bringing the truth out, because we have such a massive amount of illegal aliens coming across the borders through our southern states, Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona, and they're destroying, not only are they destroying the land with the trash they're leaving, and they're getting up here, right here in Little Rock, we actually have a Mexican gang in Southwest Little Rock that committed two murders last week. You're not going to get that in the New York Times or the Frontline paper in Dallas-Fort Worth. And very few people even in Arkansas have heard about the Mexican gangs that are moving into the Southwest Little Rock area. There is a big problem out there, and I just wanted to chime in with some of the statements. I just came to mind that George Takei, his father came to the United States in 1926 from Japan, and therefore he came here legally. So I'm kind of lost with the Sino Russian agreement where the Japanese weren't allowed to come to the United States.
Well, I think it would have been a very unusual thing. Teddy Roosevelt was involved in negotiating the peace treaty between Japan and the Russians after the Sino-Japanese War. After the Russo-Japanese War. And one of the provisions included in that was what was called the Gentleman's Agreement, which amounted to the fact that Japan would, on its side, prevent Japanese from emigrating. Now, maybe a few people were permitted to emigrate, but the general understanding was that Japan would send no more immigrants to the United States. The question, of course, that on which our host and I disagree, and it's one that I'd like to explore a little further, is whether a nation does have the right to consider itself white or black or Mexican or whatever it is, and to define itself in terms of ethnicity or some other exclusive definition.
Well, I feel that no nation has that right because we're all God's people.
Well, so you think that Israel, for example, it should be letting in Muslim immigrants?
That, I'm not an Israeli, and I don't live in Israel, and I'm trying to justify the fact that they have a right to have a country. I can't find that. It was set up by a group of Illuminatiists.
Well,
that's for another subject.
Sure.
I care about what's going on right here. In the 50 sovereign states that we have, two of those states are located outside the boundaries of the 48. We have a big time problem, and I'd like to. And I applaud you in what you're doing. I'd like to know what you're doing to help us not basically keep America white, but to keep the illegal aliens out. There are some great men in our history that are of another ethnic persuasion, and I will mention one off the top of my head is George Washington Carver, who his family was forced to come here. But again, we go back to the number of the Japanese scientists that are here and the number of Russian scientists that are here that are not Russians. Most people think all Russians are white, but there are 80% of the Russian population is of Asian descent.
Well, I think a large number of Russian immigrants are actually Jews. I think there are very few who are Asian. They wouldn't be Chinese or Tatar. But
I
disagree
with that because there's the largest contingency of Russians that I know of is in Seattle, Washington, and there are hardly any Russian Jews in that community.
Well, they're Asians? I mean, are they Russian Chinese? I mean, that sounds like a contradiction.
No, sir. That's a misnomer in the sense of what you're trying to evaluate them as, do they look like Chinese? No, they live in the Asian continent. All you have to do is look at the map. They are of a Caucasian descent.
Yes, yes.
If you want to look at a racial perspective, but they live and work and survive in the Asian continent.
They commingle with the
Chinese descendants of Genghis Khan's era. Through that mix, they don't look like, or I shouldn't say look, they don't have the severe facial features of the Chinese, nor do they have the severe facial features of the Caucasians.
Well,
so going back to the problem at hand, my question to you specifically is,
right,
what is your organization planning or attempting to do to stop this influx of the uneducated illegal aliens that are coming here and basically destroying our system, in as much as you are very correct on the fact that if they get arrested, that they have to have all these these people come to court to speak their language,
yes,
et cetera. It's a big draw on the
yes,
local taxpayer.
Well, we publish a monthly newsletter called American Renaissance, and the listeners can subscribe right online at our webpage, which is amren.com. We've been publishing for over 15 years, actually, and we have more than 10 years worth of back issues on the webpage. And our job is to publish a monthly magazine, and also we hold conferences every 2 years in which we discuss these issues. They're open to the public. We have hundreds of people who come to these conferences, and we encourage activism locally and at the national level to try to reverse these policies. But information about all of our activities is available at amren.com.
And do you support the new movement of the Arizona, I'm gonna, I use this term only because I have nothing better, the Southern Arizona Militia, who have formed a large contingency of civilian farmers who have looking at setting up a border patrol and taking possession of these illegal aliens coming across, and just last week they stopped 300.
Yes, absolutely. We have supported them. We recommend that our readers and the visitors to our webpage, we have a very active webpage, and we have promoted their activities. We think that our government has betrayed us. Our government constitutionally has the responsibility to protect the country against invasion. This happens to be an unarmed invasion, but the consequences of their arrival are exactly as if Mexico had militarily invaded and captured parts of the United States. It's becoming increasingly Mexican, which is exactly what would happen if they had won the Mexican-American War. And so if private citizens must take that responsibility into their hands, absolutely, God bless them.
Drew, thank you so much.
This is the last fastest 4 hours of radio, so I'm going to surrender to the next caller.
I appreciate
it, Frank.
You too, buddy. Take care. Andy in Texas, welcome to the show. Andy in Texas, welcome to the show. All right, I guess Andy's not there. Moving along. John in Florida, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Yes.
Okay. Just so you know, I my father worked for the IMF for about 30 years, and I did a small internship at the World Bank, and that's as ethnically diverse as a workplace as you ever want to get. And there's a couple things I learned while I was over there. One, our immigration policy is totally unfair. They treat people of different, mostly from different countries differently. And it's not based on anything skin color. It's more of a political thing, I think. And also, when you go to the lunchroom at the World Bank or the IMF, you have like a United Nations of cafeteria kind of thing, where everyone from their own kind of country sits on one table and they all speak of the same language. The difference between that and it's nothing to do with race. It has to do with familiarity. They speak the same language. They have something in common. And I think the difference between that and the college kids when I was in college is that I think the black people sat together, Jewish people sat together, white people, and then there was some that mixed, but that was more of a, we came from the same background, we came from the same kind of, you know, the commonality, that same similarity there. They have something that they can relate to, and I think that's why they congregate. And I think that racism is inherent in everyone. I think it's a natural human thing, whether it's a really bad case of racism or, oh, just because the government does it, it's okay. It doesn't matter. It's still racist. So whether the Japanese don't let other people in because they're not Japanese or whatever, that doesn't mean it's okay. It's still racism. And that's part of human nature. We have to live with it and deal with it. But it doesn't make it okay.
Well, I think it's important to recognize that it is part of human nature, and if you can build a country that recognizes human nature and takes that into consideration, I think you're far better off than trying to build a country on the assumption that human nature can be changed or overruled. What we're trying to do now is pretend that there is no human nature, or if there is, that it can be changed and abolished. And that, I think, is a terrible mistake.
Hang on a second here, Jared. And, John, you hang on as well. Folks, we'll be right back with more Frankly Speaking Radio. Good morning, folks. Welcome back to the show, Frankly Speaking Radio, heard worldwide on the Republic Broadcasting Network. I'm your host, Frank Whalen. Welcome, my friends. The phone number to interact, 1-800-313-9443. Our guest, of course, Jared Taylor from American Renaissance. Jared, welcome back to the show. Your website is amren.com, A-M-R-E-N.com. If they go on the main page, there's a link that you put up there in conjunction with this interview, which I appreciate. And also is a great place for people that can put comments about things that they're hearing in case they can't get through on the phones, because from what I understand, every line is occupied at this time. So obviously, Jared, people want to chat. So let's bring back John from Florida. And John, if I understand what you're saying correctly, you're saying that people gather because of like interests rather than the color of skin. Now, obviously, like interests or a common interest would be being able to communicate. So I understand there. But, you know, I've seen it myself with the sports teams at different universities. People will go and they'll have a sports dorm. It doesn't matter what color skin you are, but your common interest would be the sport that you all play. Is that sort of where you're going with that?
Yeah, I mean, just a case in point, I grew up in a neighborhood where I was the one out of two white kids in the whole block. And for the first 12, 13 years of my life, all I could relate to was pretty much black and Hispanic people. And so that was normal to me. And so when I got into a private school where everyone was white except for two people, it was almost like a culture shock for me. And so I didn't relate to those people as well as I did to the other people, because that's not where I grew up. But after, you know, several years in that environment, of course, I made my way, so to speak. But I think it's how you grow up, it's what you relate to, and obviously skin color is the most it's a visual thing, so obviously if you see someone with the same skin color to you as you, I mean, you're less intimidated, you're more apt to accept them or whatever. It's just, like I said, it's a natural thing.
When you grew up in a neighborhood of blacks and Hispanics, mm-hmm. how did the blacks and Hispanics get along? Did they mix absolutely freely, or did the blacks tend to stick with the blacks and the Hispanics with the Hispanics?
It was definitely a divide there.
Yeah.
I just seemed to have the right displacement, so I could kind of travel between the two groups without too much...
Well, it sounds as though you had no choice. If you were going to have any friends at all, you
sure.
had to be able to adjust.
Right, but being in... as a kid without any preconceived notions about race or without having to learn anything right away, it didn't seem unnatural to me. Like, at first, I didn't notice the skin color to me until maybe I started getting more white friends, and they were saying, well, how come all of your friends are black? Or, you know, what's this guy Buster doing at your house? Or how come you don't have any white friends? I mean, and then it started to get to me, but then I started to realize, that's weird that I don't have any white friends until now, but it never really hit me until someone brought it up to me. You know what I mean?
Well, the fact of the matter is, I actually grew up in Japan,
mm-hmm.
and I was the child of missionaries, and where I grew up out in the Japanese countryside, there weren't any other white people around. We were the only honkies for miles and miles. And so, of course, all my friends were Japanese, but... if there are just one or two of you, then you have no choice, really. You have to assimilate.
True.
But once a minority group reaches a critical mass where it can establish its own community, then the attractions of that minority group tend to prevail, and then you don't get this kind of interaction. It's obviously the case that any society can absorb a certain small number of very different people. However, as soon as that community becomes large enough to establish its own contacts, then very naturally, and it's this process that you described, it's a natural process, our loyalties go back to our original language or religion or ethnicity or race, and I think that's something that a society really can do nothing about. We can rant and rave about it. In fact, every pillar of American society preaches the idea that, no, that stuff doesn't matter, that we're all Americans, and yet, everywhere you turn, there is clear and convincing evidence that it does matter, no matter what society tries to tell us.
I agree. I mean, I lived in a neighborhood that went, as I grew up in high school, that became 60% Korean, and it's in a suburb right outside of Washington, D.C. And, I mean, I could see how they create their own churches, their own communities, they have their own grocery stores, their own shopping malls.
That's right.
And there are some places in that county where you need to speak Korean. And it's pretty weird. And
it is weird.
And this is in Maryland, in the middle of Montgomery County, Maryland, one of the richer counties in the country. So these people have grouped together, they helped each other, and you know, that's the way it should be. And they just happen to be all the same race because that's their common out, you know, their common link. And
the thing is, I think that it is, I mean, you can, any country can tolerate something like that on a small scale. A Korean town in the middle of one county in the United States. I mean, that's a kind of an exotic and amusing, even interesting thing. But once you get, say, if the United States were 30% Korean,
mm-hmm.
then you would have that kind of solidarity that extended into business, into politics, into foreign relations. That would be a very, very divisive thing for the United States. Imagine if 30% of the United States had ingrown loyalties, limited loyalties as intense as those Koreans.
Mm-hmm.
That's not at all a good thing. And yet, that is precisely the kind of thing that our immigration policies are encouraging. We now, for example, have Indian communities, Pakistani communities. They have brought with them their hostilities of the Indian and Pakistan conflict, and at the same time, they are trying very hard to influence the United States in its foreign policy to favor one rather than the other. Those things are very dangerous.
Well, just before I get off the phone...
Quickly.
So you're saying that people of white ethnicities that don't agree with the United States...
All right, hold on. You're going to have to stay on, John. Okay. Hang on. And Jared, you hang on as well. Folks, we'll be right back. Good morning, folks. Welcome back. You are listening to Frankly Speaking Radio, heard around the world on the Republic Broadcasting Network. I'm your host, Frank Whelan. Welcome, my friends, to the big show. Our guest today from American Renaissance, Jared Taylor, is with us. Jared, welcome back. And, John, quickly ask your question, and I'll let you listen off air, okay?
Sure.
All right, thanks.
You mentioned earlier that you said that the Indians and the Pakistanis and all these people were bringing over their political baggage, their anti-American sentiments and all that. But I'd say that just because someone's not white, or they could be white with those same sentiments and everything, and just because, you know... That's not a very good argument. That's a very racist argument. You know,
well,
they could be Irish and have the same kind of hostility towards us. Anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you, John.
Go ahead, Jared. The fact is that after a couple of generations, most European ethnics are indistinguishable in terms of per capita income, education levels, whether they've come from Italy or Germany or Scandinavia. And there's a great deal of intermarriage among European ethnics. And they have assimilated in a way that people who are non-white have not. After all, there are two non-white groups that have been here ever since, long before most European ethnics began to arrive. And that's blacks and American Indians. The point is, and this is something that very few people want to deal with because it makes them very uncomfortable, race is a very, very serious dividing line. And if people are of the same race, and certainly if they've come from the same continent, generally the same kind of Christian heritage, there are few boundaries that keep them apart and keep them from intermarrying and assimilating. It's people who are from a different tradition, and if they are biologically of a different race, that becomes a real barrier, as the existence and the persistence of black separation and Indian separation in this country proves.
All right. Rodney in Texas, welcome to the show.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning, my friend.
Yes, good morning, Mr. Taylor.
Good morning.
I appreciate the information you're sharing this morning. It's seemed like it's well thought out.
Thank you.
And you made a lot of interesting statements, and I'd like to ask you, some questions about some of the statements that you made. For example, you mentioned dual citizenship. You have a problem with that?
Yes, I think that every citizen of every nation should have a primary loyalty to that nation. If, for example, the United States were to go to war with Mexico for some reason, it's not inconceivable, what are we going to do with 30 million Americans who are also Mexican citizens?
Well,
I think it's a crazy state of affairs.
Well, here's the anomaly with that is that Mexicans nor blacks or any other race that I can think of really exploit dual citizenship like the Jews do. And in fact, they exploit it to the point where when many of them are caught spying on our country, they're given a ticket back over to Israel and basically a slap on the hand. But I haven't heard you mention the Jews. Is there a reason why you haven't particularly mentioned them as the ones who exploit that policy?
The subject has not come up specifically in that term. I mean, don't forget that there's Mr. Pollard, who's been in jail for, 17, 18 years now, spying for Israel. So it's not as though any Israeli spy gets off the slap on the wrist.
Mr. Pollard is in prison here or over in Israel?
Oh, he's in prison here.
He's in prison here, but Jared, I don't think we want to open that. It's a completely different subject. Because of there was a Pentagon a spy that was discovered. AIPAC was involved. And that was completely swept under the rug. So
right.
It's a separate subject.
Now, back to the earlier statement that you made about you had no problems with getting rid of anti-discrimination policies. Really aren't what you're saying, Mr. Taylor, only you're cloaking it, is that you don't have a problem with allowing racism to run rampant in this country?
What I'm in favor of is complete freedom of association. If I'm an employer and I want to employ only women, or only left-handed duck hunters, or only black people, or only white people, that should be my choice. I think that I should be able to choose my employees the way I choose my wife. The government doesn't stand over my shoulder and say, uh-oh, that looks like racial discrimination to me. No, I can choose my wife for good reasons, bad reasons, or no reasons at all. And I should have exactly the same freedom of association when it comes to my employees or the people I do business with.
That's very interesting. Another interesting statement that you made, and all of these, I think they have some serious anomalies in some of the arguments that you made, including your last reply. But I'm not going to backtrack on that.
Go ahead. What's wrong? I think it's a very important point. I think that if black people who, in fact, black people very frequently do this. There was a survey of black-owned businesses in Philadelphia. Every one of them had at least 50% black employees, and the average was 80%. Now, the black population of Philadelphia is not 80%. But those people, they deliberately go out and hire black people. I see nothing wrong with that. The point is, whites cannot do that, but blacks can technically violate the non-discrimination laws. They will not get in trouble. Those laws are enforced only against whites.
Okay. And you can prove that without a doubt.
Well, very occasionally, a public employer, a police department, for example, a police department will say, go in, and they get a black police chief. The black police chief fires all the white superintendents. Very occasionally, they will sue, and they'll get a settlement. But in terms of a private employer, if a black radio station, how many whites are going to get a job for a black radio station? It's virtually impossible. Whereas you have had gospel music stations in the United States that have not had the sufficient number of blacks that meets the same proportion as in the population, and they can get sued for racial discrimination. Those laws are almost exclusively applied against whites. But my point is, if a black employer wants to hire only black employees, that should be entirely his business. The government should have nothing whatsoever to do with those private decisions.
Okay, I'm going to move on to my next point that you made
quickly.
A statement about. You said that Europeans, and white Europeans, in your opinion, come into this country, I guess historically in your mind, have no problems with assimilating and more than likely would not bring any type of impropriety into this country.
There's some exceptions, but by and large, they assimilate much better than non-whites.
And could you give me some examples? I mean, because that's a pretty serious statement to make.
Well, look at it this way. There have been tensions that the Irish and the English brought. When the Irish came after the potato famine, they suffered a considerable amount of discrimination at the hands of the majority Anglos on the East Coast, for example. But that pretty much dissipated after a generation or two.
Well,
on the other hand, blacks who have been present in the North American continent since 1620 for a whole lot longer than the Irish have been here, there is still a lack of assimilation that's quite notable, and it's this biological fact of race that prevents assimilation. Whereas if they are whites after a generation or two, they really become largely indistinguishable. There'd be kind of a folkloric recollection of, say, oh, my grandmother was Swedish, or my folks are Italian. But by and large, in terms of education, in terms of affiliation, in terms of income, white ethnics end up assimilating to a kind of Anglo-Saxon norm quite easily.
Well, just I'm going to say this, and I'll get off the line here. Are you familiar with Operation Paperclip?
No, I'm not familiar with that.
Okay, well, I'll just give you the gist of what Operation Paperclip involved. It involved a number of Nazis, very wealthy, very educated Nazis, who were allowed to come back into this country after they had committed a number of atrocities against the Jews and other ethnic groups during the Adolf Hitler era, and I know you're familiar with that, and come right back over here to this country and be able to assimilate, as you say. And, in fact, probably a lot of them are in our current government, or they have descendants running our government right now. Do you think that when that was allowed to happen, that immigration was applied fairly in that situation? And if, in fact, these people, and they did, were Nazis, and they had a hand in the murder of millions of Jews and other ethnic groups, other races, don't you think that those people should have been held accountable for that?
Well, as a matter of fact, there's a special office in the State Department, I believe. It's called the Office of Special Investigations, whose job it is, up until this day, more than half a century after the end of the war, to root through the records and find any kind of Nazi criminals who may be in the United States and make sure they get kicked out. I think if any people slip through, there's a considerable effort now to track them down. In terms of the extent to which ex-Nazis have somehow run the United States government, Wernher von Braun,
that's documented, Mr. Taylor. That's very well documented that it did happen.
Well,
finally, your 1924 immigration policy, were you aware that that policy, that immigration policy, was put into practice or helped to the statutes were basically assembled by a lot of eugenics, American eugenics, who also had very, very close ties with Nazi Germany. Were you aware of that? When you go back and you do your homework, and it's out there, if you do a Google search, 1924 Immigration Act, you'll find that some of the biggest backers of that act were people who were, very, very heavy supporters of Nazi Germany.
Well, no, you're mistaken on that. The McCarran-Walters Act was passed by a majority of Congress. And the people who were in support of eugenics at that time, that was a very, very broad section of the United States as well as Europe. Winston Churchill was a big supporter of eugenics, for example. You can't very well include him with being a Nazi.
Oh, yes, you can.
Well, I guess you can try.
I can. Rodney, I'm going to let you go, okay?
All right, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor.
Certainly, thank you.
Let's go to Carl in Texas. Carl, welcome to the show.
Hello, Frank.
Yes, sir.
I'm living right here on the Texas border, right across from Mexico, so I go into Mexico, I do speak Spanish, and so I do have a view of what the Mexicans think and what they do and how they're coming up here.
Well, tell us about it. What is your impression?
Well, I'm very much in agreement with Jared on what he has said.
Thank you.
Most of the communities that I go into, and I go into many different states in Mexico, the people will tell me how many people they know that are up here in the United States working. Mm-hmm. And, of course, looking at it from the Mexican standpoint, I can understand fully why they do.
Yes.
Because it is very difficult to find work there in Mexico, and the pay is very low.
Yes.
In other words, they make maybe in a week what a man can make up here in an hour.
Right.
People up here don't realize the difference.
Yes.
But I've lived among the people. I sleep in their homes. I eat their food. What I do is show videos in their churches, Christian videos.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I'm not against the Mexican people, not in any way. But nevertheless, what you have said about their illegal entry into the United States is very true. Now, this has been known by governments throughout the world from the very starting of history. In other words, Babylon, when they went into Israel and defeated Israel, they took the educated, they killed whoever they wanted to, but they took the ones they wanted to back to Babylon, and then they moved people from Babylon and countries around there back into Israel. Now, this is a thing that has been known by governments throughout the history of the world. I'll give you another example. The open leader of communism here in the United States back many years ago was William C. Foster. William C. Foster. He wrote a book called Toward Soviet America. And in this book, he gave various points that he wanted to achieve in order to defeat us as a nation, in other words, to move us towards Soviet America. And I can tell you, if you've ever read those points, you know we have moved towards Soviet America. Okay, now one of the things he said was he was in favor of intermarriage among the races.
Yes.
Why? Because that is one manner to defeat a nation. Now, what do the Russians do when they go into, you know, Russians have many different racial groups within what was Russia.
Yes.
And in order to defeat an area, they go in, they kill, and move out the people that live there, and they move in other people. Now, this is what they do in the modern day. The Russians know this. This fact very well. It's a thing that that is not unknown. People who are a little bit intelligent know this is a way to defeat a nation.
Well,
and so what you have said about a mixed group of people trying to form a nation is true. I'm just 100% back of what you have said.
Well, thank you. I think that the idea of somehow building a functioning nation to which people can have real loyalty, but one that is mixed of every possible religion, race, language, etc., it's just folly. A nation has to be composed of people with real fellow feeling. And I think that the strongest sense of fellow feeling is basically a tribal one. And a nation that's composed of a homogeneous group is almost like an extended family. And it's that kind of extended family in which you can have a democracy in which people are defeated with no hard feeling if, as the United States becomes increasingly multiracial, our elections will simply become racial headcounts. The Mexicans will vote for the Mexican candidate. The whites will vote for the white candidate. The blacks will vote for the black candidate. It's already happening now. You just can't run a country in which there is no sense of being in this together. And I think that one of the earlier callers was discussing the possibility of a kind of collapse. Well, should that collapse come, I think that the built-up inter-ethnic and interracial tensions in this country will come right to the surface, and what we see now as a kind of a smoldering resentment could break into real inter-ethnic and interracial flame.
Of course, any time you say the word race or racism, this is a psychopolitical term that the communists have explored and used and propagandized for decades, and so that's why so many callers are,
Carl,
are confused
we,
on this situation.
Thank you for the call, sir. Jared, hang on a second. We'll come right back, folks, and we'll wrap up the show. Stay with us. Good morning, my friends. Welcome back to the big show. We call it Frankly Speaking Radio, heard around the world on the Republic Broadcasting Network. I'm your host, Frank Whalen. Yes, the dwindling moments of the program, and certainly a big thank you to my guest today, Jared Taylor from American Renaissance, who doubled the time that he was going to spend with us today. Jared, I thank you very much. I want to ask you about how people can sign up for the newsletter and how they can donate money. But first, I would like to say this, that I remember the one-year anniversary of September 11th. Now, when September 11th occurred, we all remember what that was like. I happened to be on the air, and my four-hour show turned into a I don't know, 8 to 10 hour marathon, and it was exhausting, and it was on every level. And I remember the next year, on the anniversary, we did some things here on the show and whatnot. And I remember there's a gal who works downstairs at the Hispanic station. She came up with a couple of her coworkers, and she said, "Frank, I just want you all to know that we're with you on this. You know, this is a tough time for all Americans." And that really moved me. That was really something special. And the way I look at it, I think you got to treat these things as a case-by-case basis. Look at the individual, not the group and not the stereotype, but rather the personal interactions that you might have. I do think that there are clashes of cultures. I do think there's a lack of effort on the part of some groups of people, be they immigrants or even American citizens, be they from Mexico or anywhere else, who refuse to really sort of allow an integration process to let themselves feel like Americans and let us feel that they are fellow Americans as a result. It's an interesting sort of problem. But in the grand scheme of things, do I fear a slow Mexican influx that's going to allow this country to be taken over? No. There are much bigger battles out there to fight and much greater evils in the world. So this is not... it doesn't seem like it is a problem, but it's not the biggest problem. So therefore, I'd have to say, Jared, that I disagree with your opinions, but I can't disagree with your facts. And that having been said, my friend, I do appreciate your time today. Please go ahead, plug the website and all the information out there.
All right. Our webpage is amren.com, and people can buy a certain number of interesting books. They can subscribe to American Renaissance. They can learn about our conferences and other activities. And perhaps if you invite me back on your program again, I can win you round to a more broad-based understanding of the crisis that we face.
It is certainly possible. As I always tell the listeners, I encourage everyone to make up their own mind. I'm not going to tell the listeners what to think. They're entitled to their own opinion, as you are, sir. And judging by the reaction and the, I would say, probably 10 phone calls we didn't get to since you've been on, if obviously there's an interest, I'll have you back. If you're interested, we can certainly do something.
Well, it's been my pleasure. I appreciate you having me on.
Jared, thank you very much, sir. I appreciate you spending so much time with us today.
Certainly.
Take care.
Goodbye.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to do it for today's show. What can I say? I must admit I'm kind of surprised that the overwhelming acceptance of Jared's opinions, I guess. But I do understand that you guys have always treated the guests with the utmost respect, and I don't run a show that encourages people to bash each other. So I do appreciate that. I think we learn more by having a civil discussion, and we need to take that to the next level and realize that, again, folks, what's the one thing that transcends all language barriers, all nationalities, all age groups, all economic levels, all social levels, all physical levels? It's the truth, and that's what we operate in here, is the truth. And to me, the pursuit of the truth and the pursuit of freedom, reveling the joy of being in the truth, being in the know about what is going on in the world around you, it transcends all that. And in the grand scheme of all that, all that we know about the New World Order and Lucifer behind the whole big thing, does it really matter if the $6 an hour jobs are and money is being sent to Mexico? I don't know. I don't see it so much. But have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow.